K2KEY, K2REW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I'm going to, that's exactly what Mosley, it wasn't the TVI. It was with my antenna here. Okay, he explains it. I got the bulletin out. The guy wires will behave as parasitic elements, and in our experiments, guy wires will alter or distort the radiation pattern of a nearby antenna. So, there you are. He says, however, do not compare this with a dipole. Do not compare my Yankees with a simple dipole. This is generally of no consequences with dipoles, and it only shows up on unidirectional antennas when installed on towers. This is, goes through a whole thing, but the bottom line is here that he says he claims that their experiments have shown, and it's underlined, that they distort the radiation pattern of their antennas, of his Yagis, over.
In theory, he's right. The guy wires do change the antenna pattern, but by an extremely minor amount, in my opinion. A slightly more minor amount would be the nails in the house are changing the pattern. Does it make a tenth of a dB of difference in forward gain? I doubt it, but it's possible. Does it change the front-to-back ratio that used to be 20 dB and now it's only 18? Yes, I'm going to agree with that. It is changing it. Is the change significant? I mean, everything will make a change. But is that change a lot or a little? That's what I would like to know. Back to you, Mel.
Well, you know, you got a good point there. I did not, at least I wasn't privy, of course, to looking at his measurements. The time, you know, now this is going back a good number of years. This is not something that is, you know, was recently introduced into the amateur radio market. This is something that I'm talking about, see, 25, 30 years ago when I got all this information from, like, Mosley. Now, how they did their antenna testing, of course, in that way, I guess you would be very proud of it because I think you still agree that the good old-fashioned way that, of course, he was doing it, that he had these acres of antenna range set up there. In fact, he used to advertise, Carl Mosley, if you've got some new design of a Yagi, something really that you feel that, you know, is the last word, I provide the facilities here if you want to bring it here, and I'll provide you with any kind of power up to 150 feet and measuring systems that they had, and you can, you know, compare it. We have the facilities here. So they were doing everything basically by, you know, the old-fashioned method, Dick. This is no computers or whatever. This is his antenna ranges were basically what I think you still look at as the core of testing antennas, over.
It sounds like Mr. Mosley made an offer that people could have their antennas tested at his facility. Do you believe a significant number of amateurs took him up on that offer, Mel?
I think so. I think he was always looking for some new design, that a radically new design that would, again, pop him on the top. You know, he was very nice man to talk to. A little bit stubborn, I will say, because, you know, he insisted that his construction was the last word in antenna construction. And his big controversy was with Telrex. Telrex was the company that, you know, had the through-the-boom elements. They did not mount elements on the boom. Carl Mosley used those aluminum casted saddles to hold the antenna element on top of the boom. Whereas Telrex had the elements through the boom. And that's where the big controversy started. Which system is the right system to go by, Dick? Over.
If the elements are insulated from the boom, it's a wash. There'll be a slight difference in the toning of the element when it goes through the boom as opposed to sitting on top. My only objection is that if the elements go through the boom and the element is making aluminum to aluminum contact with the boom, and if it's more than a three-element Yagi, then that aluminum oxide that builds up changes the tuning, and in some cases that can be significant, particularly let's say an 18-element VHF or a 22-element UHF antenna. I acquired four Yagis of the, W1HTQ, Ed Tilton. They were called Ed Tilton Yagis, 13-element Yagis, 432, eighth-inch diameter wire rod was the elements themselves, and they all went through the boom with some kind of a saddle mechanism to hold onto them. And these particular antennas I acquired had been out in the weather for a couple of years. And I went down the boom with my ohm meter and found out that roughly half the elements no longer made any contact to the boom. And I know that creates detuning. So it's an insidious thing where the gain can slowly be disappearing on your Yagi. And you don't know it because you readjust your thinking to it day to day. So elements to the boom are not bad if they're insulated from the boom, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel. KYW.
The thinking of that time on those beams that they were building big beams for government use, full-size beams for bands like 40 meters. The military or the government use of by 40 meters nearby frequency. It was 6.9 megahertz, I believe it was, somewhere around that. And some of them were fairly big arrays. I mean, these were not, you know, these are full-size arrays, wide-spaced monsters. And, of course, Telerex produced that big Bertha antenna, that whole rotary pole set up that was, I saw one, a phenomenal piece of hardware. Now, the through-the-boom system that Telerex was using, they heliod the element. They had these, pieces stick out either side of the boom, and then you connected your elements onto the extension onto there. But the elements where they were at contact, the pieces that were on contact, called the boom, were heliarced at that point. Whereas mostly, they, except for the driven element, was also, grounded to the boom, and he used these large casted saddles. These cast saddles using double three-eighths U-clamps, stainless steel U-clamps. They were, I think, 3/8 or 5/16. I don't remember. Heavy U-clamps made out of stainless steel. To each, that's what secured each element to the boom. And you can well imagine it was a battle back and forth for the contracts. But at that time, but that was Mosley's design, Dick, over.
Okay, so the elements were held down to the boom with these very stoochy hose clamps. But what was the element mounted in? Was it a chunk of metal that was cast in the right shape, or was it a chunk of plastic? Back to you, Mel.
Cast aluminum. It was a saddle that it was casted to, had the curve, proper curve. And it sat in there, and then it was a way that it was like a double saddle, very cleverly laid out with a special clamping plate on top. And he gave you that, you packed it with the, before you installed it, you packed it with that grease, and then put a sealer on top of it. And I've used that, and I've had no problem with that antenna. In fact, I had that antenna down, Mosley antenna down, was it 2 years ago? Yeah, 2 years ago. I had all the elements off, and I took a look, and it was clean as a whistle where it was making contact like that. I buffed it, really buffed it up, and repacked it again with the grease and all that stuff. But it stood up extremely well. However, with the through-the-boom system that Telerex had, They were heliarching it at that point, Dick, over.
Yeah, it sounds like an expensive process. With the heliarching properly done, I suspect you can make very good contact and it's not going to change. When the element sits in a cast aluminum saddle and sits on top of the boom, I think you're saying the element was held to the saddle with two hose clamps, and the saddle was held to the boom with two hose clamps, and on least the element to saddle interface, you put a conductive grease in there, a weatherproofing conductive grease. Wow. Is that what you were saying, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger, it wasn't hose clamps, it was U-clamps, stainless steel U-clamps. They were 3/8 or 5/16 U-clamps, very heavy U-clamps, really amazing. That I just tightened up on them. In fact, I was just working on this this past week. Went up there, and I put a wrench on each one of those clamps and made sure it still took a little bit of a turn on each one of them, then resprayed it with the stuff, the sealer. And amazing, they've been up there an awful lot of years, and they've stood in a lot of storms and things, and that beam is, I can't complain. It's worked out extremely well on 20, 15, and 10 meters. So it is was well constructed, and that was the bottom line with Bosley. There was no, you know, corners. And it was a little pricey for the time, and that's why I guess he doesn't depend on amateur radio as his market. But he did produce a quality product, which don't see much of him anymore. I guess he's gone on to, well, he's not alive anymore, but I guess the company, I don't know exactly what they're producing today anymore, Dick, over.
Yeah, question number one, Mel, does Mosley and Telerex both still exist? I should know, but I don't. Another factor is that when the elements are sitting on top of the boom as opposed to going through the boom itself is a little stronger. Although the major strength you want of the boom is vertical strength, vertical deflection. The horizontal deflection, well, I take it back. The horizontal in the wind is a factor. You do get more strength with the element sitting on top. He also could have put a simple sheet of plastic of some kind, an ultraviolet protected plastic, in between the element and the saddle. Although, wait a minute now, that wouldn't work so well with the U-bolt. Was there a pair of U-bolts, one on the starboard side and one on the port side of each element, holding it to that saddle? And was there an indentation in the saddle mechanism where the backup plate of the U-bolt goes? Or was there holes in the saddle itself for the U-bolt and then the nuts on the U-bolt were on the back side of the saddle? How was that done, Mel? Sounds like a very stoochy arrangement. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was, well, those elements were big. Those are big, heavy elements. That beam was the big beam that he produced, the ones, like I say, for 40 meters, the big ones for 20 and all, you know, full-size beams. They were heavy beams. They had a large diameter boom. They had things like, you know, struts that supported, that went out, ran out to the either side, you know, to support the weight of the elements and all. And how the saddles were, they were casted aluminum saddles. And it had on each side of the cast aluminum saddle, they had a U-clamp that went through the castings. In other words, the U-clamp went around the bottom of the boom, then went up through the saddle, and then there was a clamping plate on top that was in the shape of the, in other words, it closed off. If you looked at the, if you held one of the saddles and you laid the clamping plate on top of it, it was the shape of the element, round, Dick, over.
You said clamping plate. Wow. Okay, so on the top of each element is a clamping plate so that you're distributing the force of the U-bolts, so the U-bolts are not biting into the element. If I correctly. Very similar to the clamping plate you've got on a ham M rotator, where it grabs onto its mast. So I think you're saying each element had a clamping plate over it, and the U-bolts worked through that clamping plate into the casting, and then the nuts or on the back side of the, on the underside of the casting? Is that what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, they're not stuck up. In other words, if you looked, if you held a clamp, you would put the U-clamp in from the bottom of the boom. It would stick up, go through the casted plate on top that was sitting on top on each side of the clamping plate along the boom, and then on top of that, to pull it together, in other words, you laid the element in, and then you put the plate on top of it that had four holes punched into it, that squeezed down and clamped the whole contraption together, you know, the elements, the U, tighten the U clamps up, everything tightens up with that clamping plate on top, Dick, over.
And that clamping plate on top either had the curve in it that matched the element, or it had a V groove in the center. Is that what it had, sort of like the ridge board of a house? It had the shape of the peak of a roof of a house. Go ahead.
It was round. No, it actually clamped down on the element. There was just the right clearance that it pulled down tight enough onto that element, and the boom and all that stuff tightened up, didn't crush anything. Very clever. I mean, it was, like I say, costly stuff. That was, you know, expensive stuff. And Telerex also, you know, these were for the certain amateur radio people that had the money at the time, because you know what the cost of things like an antenna like that, Big Bertha, back in the days when I looked at one. I went to visit a cell I knew in Jersey that had one, and at that time it had price tag like $50,000 at that time. Now I'm going back a lot of years. Now you ask me if Telerex is still in business. I don't think so. I believe Mosley is still in business, but I don't know about Telerex, over.
Mosley is owned by ProSearch. Telerex has been out of business about 20 years, Dick, and Toledo.
Thank you, Rich. Too bad. Mel, with this fancy cast aluminum saddle assembly that held the element above the boom, first of all, I presume you filled up the whole circumference of the element with this grease before you set it into the saddle and before you put the clamping plate on top. That saddle mechanism held the element how far above the boom? Was it like a pedestal, or was it a squatty structure? Go ahead.
It was very squatty. Maybe you could put your finger between the element and the boom at that point. I don't know. Maybe they're about that much clearance. Pretty close, if I remember. Remember, I'm just remembering this off the top of my head. I don't have this. I only have the single clamping Mosley version. This is the so-called the poor man's system that he sold to ham, where the clamps, these 516 stainless steel U-clamps. They have the saddle, but the saddle's single saddle, and the element lays in there. And of course, there's two holes drilled in the element, and the nuts stick up on top. So the elements sit on top of the boom that way. But on the big beams, I'm talking about the large arrays. Those things were meant to, you know, withstand tremendous amounts of punishment under maybe some very, you know, places that are really towers and places God knows where, because they were peddling it, you know, to Uncle Sam. And, of course, you can well imagine what the price tag was. I looked at that time, I remember the four-element, 40-meter, full-sized array. At that time, it was mind-boggling, the price, over.
Sounds like another one of those things like the Collins radio that you didn't feel you could afford at the time. On this really big Mosley that you're discussing, from your memory, roughly what was the diameter of the boom and what was the diameter of the center of the element? Was the boom almost 4 inches in diameter and the element 2 inches in diameter, Mel? Go ahead. And was the element tapered?
Elements were tapered out, but they started out very large, and I'll tell you how large that boom was. I once saw a picture. I don't know where it was taken. A guy had that one. He had the Yeah, the 80 meter. Yes, they did make an 80. He did make an 80 meter version. What the heck was the reason for the 80 meter? I remember a guy in California was about the only ham I ever heard that bought that 80 meter version of that Mosley put out, and he was standing out on the boom, Vic. You know, similar picture to like you took that time. He's standing out on his boom, looking out. You know, the boom looked like it went on forever. And he's standing out, and that boom was, gee, I'll bet you it was 6 inches, maybe in diameter, at least, Dick, over.
Yeah, an 80 meter, how many element 80 meters? Probably three, although that man in Japan does own a five element, fully rotatable 80 meter beam. Wow. That antenna hangs over this apartment building, or at least I think it's an apartment building, maybe it's a factory. Looks like about a seven-story building, hangs over it like an umbrella. And a number of people have talked about losing the orientation, losing the reference angle on the rotator on a windy day. And as I read these articles, I'm amazed that no one discovered that you can wind balance an antenna. The fact that your antenna slips on a windy day, you don't have to tolerate that if you make it wind balanced. So that 80 meter beam that Mosley made, was it three element? Or did they go all the way to five, Mel? Go ahead.
It's only three elements. In fact, I believe there is one in existence still. This guy resurrected one. He did, I hear him on 80 meter, 75, talked to him a few times. And, the heck, I can't remember. WW1W. I think I saw it. I think I looked at it on his picture of it. It's a 175 foot tower, and the beam sits on top of it. And he's in, where the heck is he? He bought a mountain, a hilltop someplace. Maybe in New Hampshire? Where was he? Where was he? Let me think a minute where he was. That's funny. I spoke to him a number of times, can't recall his name. Wally? Was it Wally? Or Scotty? Something. Anyhow, I believe it's called WW1W. And he has a rotating tower, Dick. Most of them are going in for rotating towers. They don't have a rotor up there. They have these huge rotors down that they make. And I saw that rotor that is put together with that chain on it. It is a piece of equipment. It's got a fairly large motor and a big bull chain on it. Over.
Yeah, I've Googled WW1W, and Google keeps thinking I'm talking about World War One. Googled WW1W antenna, and I don't think I've seen it yet. Television, dynamic, no? Haven't found it yet. I'd like to see a picture of this thing. Arnold Thompson out in Setauket owned a three-element, 80-meter, fully rotated beam on top of a Big Bertha. And before he passed away, that was something to behold. And I think he used to open up the 80-meter band first and close it down the last guy, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, yeah, I used to hear this guy on 75 meters, and he'd be really talking to the station side. Most of the time, didn't even hear. But if you go to QRZ, and then put in the call, you most likely will find it, Dick, because Googling, like you say, Google doesn't know you're looking for amateur radio sometimes. If the call letters happen to wind up, such as, you know, WW2W, like my friend Tony, that joins us once in a while here, you put that in, of course, you get World War II, something on World War II. So, you have to go to some amateur radio, go to QRZ.com and then put in the call. I think you'll find it. So, you know, these type of installations, you got to have the money, you got to have the room, you got to have a lot of factors over.
Now, am I supposed to be...
If you got an antenna that big, you have to have the power to excite it too, don't you?
Of course. Do I Google WW2W or WW1W, Mel?
W1W, but I don't think you're going to find it on Google. You're going to wind up something with World War One. If you go to amateur radio database, IQRZ, I think it'd be easier to find it, Dick. Over.
Okay, the WW1W is Ralph Gilbert in Newark, California. And I'm hoping he's going to have something indicating where is. I'll find something else that'll show pictures. He doesn't have a picture. Login? No. I don't see a way to find anything further on his call sign history is issued by the benevolent authority of the FCC. First call sign was so-and-so. Second call sign was so-and-so. Okay, the current holder is Ralph H. Gilbert. That might not be the same person, Mel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got the call wrong. Try WW1WW. I remember correctly, he says whiskey, whiskey, one, whiskey, whiskey. I think it may be with two W's. You know, I get senior moments at this time of night, Dick. So many calls running through my head all the time. I think it may be WW1WW, over.
Okay, that produced a picture of a huge antenna. Woodrow Beckford in Salisbury, New Hampshire. Current antenna. Complement of 3ELM, 3 element 80 meters at 187 feet. Okay, this is the guy. Woodrow Beckford, is that the one?
Tim, Woody. That's Woody. I forgot all about Woody. Gee, he'd kill me if he said that. I've spoken to him so many times. That's Woody. And that's his antenna. How do you like that? Now, that's... He tell me the story how they got that thing up there with a helicopter. I was flabbergasted, over.
Wow. Now, it's possible to do it without a helicopter if you're smart enough. Very dangerous procedure, in my opinion. Three elements, 80 meters at 187 feet. Three elements on 40 meters at 187 feet. Seven elements on 10 meters at 165 feet, and so on. This guy is pretty serious. And I'm sure he runs a full gallon in every one of those bands. It looks to me, from the photograph that's on QRZ.com, that one tower has almost all of those antennas. Is that one of these rotating towers, do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. That's the rotating tower. And you hear the equipment he's bought. He's got a receiver that, that ICOM 13K receiver, and all the other equipment that he had backed up. I mean, I think he won the lotto, over.
Yeah, we're talking about a good half megabuck antenna installation here, aren't we?
Oh, we're talking about a lot of money. Oh, gee, you have no idea what this installation cost. Just the rotating mechanism. What it took to put that rotating mechanism in the ground, what they had to dig out. I forgot how much material. And then they dropped in this concrete box. Actually, I guess it's one of these casted concrete boxes they put into the ground. And then the house tower fits into a bearing situation in there with the drive and all. You know, you're talking about serious money, Dick. Over.
What's your guess as to the kind of tower that's doing all this rotating? Something like Roan 85 tower?
Yeah, I think Roan makes that. I believe there's a commercial tower that, there's a lot of controversy because K3LR, another one, he went into the business. He owns now Big Bertha. He took over to Big Bertha's antenna systems. I hear him on the air talking about it. And he's selling now a Big Bertha. And that's a rotating pipe. It's a rotating piece of pipe that he says they use for drilling oil wells. And but the material they were using, they weren't using that Rowan. You know, they had the commercial... Does Rowan produce a heavier material? I know they produce a tower that I think is heavier material. Also, I think these high monsters, you know, some of these broadcast stations that have, what, 300-400 feet of power over.
When you Google WW1WW, he's got a YouTube video of what his antenna looks like. He's got a 160-meter vertical antenna with 100 ground plane radials, among other things. And this YouTube is in some of the foreign language. But, yep. There are hams out there, Mel, that have a little more money and a little more enthusiasm than you and I do. To contain something like this, the guy must have multiple acres of property up in New Hampshire. Sounds like you've talked to him a few times. And my guess is, like you said, he's hearing things on 80 meters that you're not hearing, even with your well-tuned loop antenna. And ordinarily, the D-layer absorption on 80 meter at high noon is so fierce. I wonder if he can cut through that. What do you think? K2KEY, K2RAW?
He's a midnight guy like me many times. Catch him on after midnight. He's usually on like midnight, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I've many a times sat and just listened to him working these stations. I can, some of them I can hear, barely hear. I can hear him, and he's giving them 5.5, 5.7, 5.9 reports, you know. And I'm just flabbergasted that, you know, he's able to hear these stations that well. And like I say, with that setup, I'm sure that it's capable. Yeah, he's a serious ham. He's one of the serious guys, like K3LR is another serious. These are the big, as we call them, the big guns. And I know when the contests are running or whatever, I listen, I know they're the ones. They always come out on top of one of these guys. So there's a battle between them, I see. So it's really come down to the battle of about, I don't know, about a dozen places, a dozen stations in the United States. W6, the heck is AM out there in California is another one. But if you look at their antenna installation, take a look at K3LR. He's another one that's right here in Pennsylvania that'll it's mind-boggling what he has. I think they're trying to, you know, like, I guess it's like the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building when they were going up over.
I found a website that shows some of the photographs of his antennas and an element being repaired and so on. Looks like fun. I presume some of these big guns don't run single operator during contests. In other words, quite a few of their buddies will maintain this equipment for him during a contest, so it becomes a multi operation. Is that true?
Well, it's a professional operation. Let me tell you. You know, take a look at K3LR, and he'll tell you about the contesting that they have. He's actually got professional amateur radio contests. These guys are whizzes, many of them at CW, or whizzes at, you know, just at phone up, whatever operation they are, top-notch people. And he's got multiple operating positions with the best of equipment that, you know, the all the rigs that they market now in the 10K and up category. I mean, that's what they run. I mean, just take a look, you know, he went into the business of installing antennas, now big arrays, K3LR, and you'll take a look at what he's selling. It's, like I say, his prices are are for those who win the lotto, over.
Gee, I guess we got to play the lotto a little more, Mel. Okay, do you have some more mail that we should be answering? Over to you, sir.
Of course, I'm just looking at ones that are interesting here, and ground wire. We're talking about ground wire, that's why it caught my eye. If my ground wire, does it have to be different lengths, different bands? Because I understand the ground wire, should it be almost exactly a quarter wavelength for that particular band? So what happens if I do not have proper length on my ground wire, or do I need several of them? Over.
I am guessing that because the counterpoise wires, your ground plane radials, are trying to act like a sheet of metal, and they're in contact with a reasonably conductive substance called Earth, and that causes them to be almost non-resonant. Therefore, if your radials are long enough for the lowest frequency, it is my belief they're going to give you almost all of the performance you want for the higher frequency, and maybe more, because even with quarter-wave radials on each individual, well, let's assume that I've got a ground plane, vertical ground plane antenna for one single band, and I set up a whole bunch of radials that are all quarter-wave long, and if I made those radials longer than quarter-wave, I don't think I would lose performance, I think I would gain a little performance. Because the best performance you're going to get out of a vertical antenna is if you put it into an infinite, put it on top of an infinite sheet of copper that went for long distances in every direction. Therefore, I think you should set up your radials to be long enough for the lowest band, and don't worry about putting shorter ones for the next higher band. That's my belief, but I haven't done it. I wonder if you know anyone who has. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is another thing that has been a lot of controversy, because if you bring this up and you say, you know, difference between DC grounding is not really an RF ground, you know, and they say DC, what DC, what DC? Well, DC is basically, if we look at the subject of putting a ground rod down and grounding your equipment to that ground rod, we actually could say this is basically a DC ground. So at RF, what happens? In fact, I guess at RF, if the antenna, let's say the ground is, let's say for argument's sake, we have a, let me think of something that makes sense. That's easy to understand. Let's go to, let's say, 10 meters. Okay, good place to start, because 10 meters. If we were to have a ground rod 8 feet down with about, say, 8 feet of wire, it should be a adequate ground for RF, DC ground at RF at, say, 10 meters. Correct, Dick? Over.
Well, hold on now. If I had a simple rod going down to the ground, as far as 110 volt or 240 volt wiring is concerned, that's a pretty good ground. As far as lightning protection is, that's a pretty good ground. But the word ground for RF is very different. Earth is kind of a dummy load volumetric material to RF frequencies. And I don't want my antenna heating up that dirt and making the worms warm. That's the reason why you spread out radials on the ground. So no matter how big that pipe is in diameter, no matter how many feet it goes down, if I've got a single pipe going down from the bottom of my vertical antenna, that is not a good RF ground. It's a moderately good ground if the antenna is a half wave long and I'm feeding it at the bottom where the impedance is over 1,000 ohms, then it's pretty good. But if it's a quarter-wave vertical radiator, the biggest pipe in the ground in diameter going a zillion feet down is not very good, because I'm still heating up the dirt around that antenna, in my opinion. Over to you, Mel.
True. Okay. Well, that's what they, you know, basically what they would talk about, using variable number of ground rods, different lengths long, because if we took, for instance, a ground rod over, let's say, average Earth, we connected it to our rig that's 8 feet away from that rod, we would have essentially a quarter wavelength on 10 meters, would it prevent RF from traveling to ground? This is the point. You see, I think this is what they're really of, where a lot of confusion is. you know, what constitutes the right grounding for an amateur radio station? I think this is what it's boiling down to, this question. You know, where is the ground system? It's actually, what is the fundamental, I think, they got the fundamental difference between DC and RF circuit ground, Dick, over.
Okay, a vertical pipe going into the ground a quarter wavelength or a half wavelength long, straight down, doesn't solve the problem. I'm still putting RF energy into that volumetric resistive material that you and I call dirt. And unless my dirt was soaked with an extremely high conductive saline solution, I can't stop it from being a volumetric dummy load. That pipe that goes down a quarter wavelength, and it's a quarter wave long, is better than nothing, but it's not good enough. It's not stopping the RF from hitting the dirt. You could say that you're laying down ground plane radials to be a poor man's equivalent of an infinite sheet of copper. And if you've got enough ground plane radials, so if the spacing between the radials is a small fraction of a RF wavelength, so that the RF cannot squeeze through that spacing and hit the dirt. If you can stop the RF from hitting the dirt, you've accomplished what you want. You've provided the counterpoise, and you've now got an efficient antenna that's not heating up Earth. You don't want to heat Earth. An RF energy that's able to touch Earth nearby to your antenna is going to create heating, and that heating is a loss mechanism. That's the way I see it, Mel. How about you, KQLIW?
Hey, for those who are somewhat new to amateur radio, Dick mentioned something that reactants, the XL factor, the inductive reactants. In this situation, if we had, let's theoretically say that, you know, you have average earth, you have a ground, a wire running to it. If that ground wire and the ground rod was somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, a quarter wavelength long, increasing that, or putting another ground rod down and increasing it to one half wavelength long, wouldn't that make the XL factor, the reactance factor, the inductive L, the RF XL factor, to, in other words, make it a lower value by going from quarter wavelength to half wavelength, ticked over.
Now, what is the object that's going from quarter wave to half wave? Tell me what the object is, Mel.
In other words, we're going to put down a ground system for it. This is what the person asked. You want to install a ground system. What would be adequate for an amateur radio station? And in reading, I guess he read into a number of factors, and the factor is, what about, I was saying, you brought up the factor of X of L, the reactance factor. And I just said, if you had a quarter wavelength rod buried in average soil, and a quarter wavelength piece of wire going from that to your rig, would you be able to better off by putting a second ground in that would be, say, a half wavelength in wavelength and lower the XL factor? Would that automatically, in other words, if I had a quarter wavelength ground system and then paralleled up with a half wave ground system, would that, in other words, reduce my XL factor, over?
Okay, before I answer that question, let me try to understand now. I've got a grounding system that's either quarter wave long or a half wave long. Is this grounding system ground plane radials that are parallel to the ground? Or are these vertical ground rods that are quarter wave or half wavelength long and therefore deep? Which are you asking there, Mel? Go ahead.
The rods. In other words, this is a grounding system. This has nothing to do with verticals, you know, radials or anything. This one wants to put down a grounding system. In other words, ground rods. He wants to put in a grounding system by using most likely several different versions of it. In other words, so that any one, as they, I guess the way they explain it, that no one single ground rod with a piece of wire is adequate. So now the point is, if you had a quarter waver, say a ground rod 8 foot long, and you drove it into average soil, and you put a rig, say 8 feet away on 10 meters, and your XL factor, you find that can it be lowered? In other words, you're going to have a reactance here, an inductive reactance most likely, by going from a quarter wavelength and then paralleled up with another ground rod somewhere that's one wavelength. Would that lower your XL factor? In other words, improve the grounding situation, Dick, over.
Okay. I think the person asking the question assumes that X of L, inductive reactance, is bad. I don't think inductive reactance is bad. Because inductive reactance, if it's a pure reactance, is not a loss mechanism. You can't continuously pour power into an inductor. You can't continuously pour power into a capacitor. So the fact that there's an inductance somewhere may complicate your situation, but it's not a loss mechanism. And the worst case grounding occurs for guys that are on top of a mountain that's struck with lightning a whole lot of time, and they're sitting on a slab of granite, and it's very hard to sink ground rods. And what they tend to do is to set down a metal mat with a whole bunch of guide clips at all of the intersection of the horizontal and vertical, the left to right. Let's see. You've got latitude copper wires, and you've got longitude copper wires, and they're crisscrossing, and where they crisscross, you put the guide clips, and at each one of these junctions, you put a rod into whatever you can, granite or earth. I mean, for good lightning protection on top of a mountain, you have to do things like this. But you're not doing that for RF reasons. RF-wise, you either want your antenna to be a half wave long, the radiator, if it's vertical, and it's ideal. You want it to be high in the air, like a dipole is high in the air. You want your antenna to create as little strong RF energy, RF field, near Earth. You don't want the RF energy to see Earth, because if it does, Earth is a volumetric resistive material. It's like a block of very low conductivity carbon. It happens to be dirt, but you know what I mean. You don't want the RF to hit it, otherwise it's going to heat it and create a loss mechanism. And a one or two or three ground rods going straight down vertical, quarter wave or half wave long, does not stop the RF energy from striking that dirt and heating up that dirt. So that's not good enough. You've got to have either altitude to the antenna to get it away from the dirt, or you've got to shield the dirt from the antenna by putting down a bunch of ground plane radials. And we tend to, we tend to lay out the ground plane radials in a star pattern. You don't have to. They can be laid out like a raster scan, a horizontal raster scan, you know, a latitude raster scan and a longitude raster scan, all parallel to the Earth. That would be a perfectly good ground plane radial system. As I see it, if you want high efficiency and you insist on vertical antennas mounted close to the ground, you've got to shield that RF energy from that ground if you want efficiency. That's my take on it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, and this is not what the question is. The question is, he's not putting up a vertical or particular antenna. He wants to know what to do to ground the amateur radio station. In other words, you connect the equipment together, basically, yes. You know, you have it all connected together, and then you have it grounded. Now, you put down one rod, two rods, five rods, and what is the pattern of the rods? What happens when the length of the wires to the rods and all, should you make them odd, quarter wavelength, one wavelength long, or as, of course, Now go back, you know, and quote the ARRL, and back in the old days when they used to say you should always have your ground wires, you know, for grounding purposes at odd multiples of a quarter wavelength. In other words, he wants to add the grounding system for the equipment, Dick. Nothing to do with, you know, what antenna he's installing, basically. In other words, what do you suggest in ground rod system, or and what kind of spacing, et cetera, over?
Yeah, I'm only partially understanding the question. I'm hearing the words, but I'm only partially understanding the writer's real intent here, his real question. There are three major reasons for doing grounding. Human safety with reference to LIPA and ConEd power to make sure you don't get electrocuted. Grounding for lightning reasons. And there's a bunch of amateur radio beliefs that if your RF ground is effective enough, you get better performance. Now, I presume he's not asking grounding for human protection. I presume he's not asking for ground with reference to lightning protection. I think we're in the arena here of a discussion on RF grounding for radio performance enhancement. That's what I think we're getting into here. And once you're talking about radio performance, as I see it, you want to make sure that very little of the field of the radio emission, your E and H field from your antenna, you don't want it to touch dirt. That's my way of looking at it. And running let's assume I'm on the second or third floor of a wooden house, and I want grounding for some reason. And I'm running a grounding rod or a grounding wire, let me pick a number, a 4-gauge wire, I run it out of the shack, out the window, straight down the side of the building, and it's going to touch earth. And it's going to touch a grounding rod system. And the main reason you're doing it for, in reality, you should be doing it for human safety and lightning safety. But if you're putting down that rod outside the third floor of this wooden house, and you're running it down to Mother Earth, and you think that's going to increase your performance of your equipment on the third floor of that building, I think it does not in itself. And a lot of people believe that. It is my belief that that is a phony belief. You may have another take on that one, Mel. Back to you, KQLIW.
I will sympathize because, you see, if you look at setting up an amateur radio station, basically in the books where you will see how to properly set up an amateur radio station, they show you that they have a ground bus. And, you know, they usually tell you, you know, that the wider it is, the more cross-section of it is, the better it is. The ground bus goes from your transmitter, grounds the transmatch or the tuner. If you have a linear amplifier, all this is tied together, and then it says to earth ground. And this is what his question seems to be lying. What constitutes a good earth ground if you're going to set up an amateur radio station? Taking into account, yes, for RF, lightning protection, human protection, and all. Overall, what do you constitute? Do you put down to the earth ground? What constitutes that? Is that a single rod, two rods? What's the spacing? What should you, in other words, do? This is what I think the question really is, Dick. What constitutes that portion of the amateur radio station? Over.
Okay, now there's a EIA standard on this. IEEE, EIA, Electronic Industries Association, RS-222 is the name of the document. And you can Google that document and you can read it. RS-222 is probably Rev Echo these days, Rev E. And it defines what constitutes good ground, what gauge of wire, what length of ground rods, how to connect them, how many feet below grade, all that kind of jazz. And that document for defining good grounding of a radio tower is primarily for lightning first, human protection second, and I don't think any of that document defining proper grounding of a commercial installation, I don't think any of that is done for radio grounding purposes per se. Your ground plane radials are around an AM broadcast station. You got a whole lot of ground plane radials. Stopping the RF energy emitted by that AM radio tower, you don't want the RF energy emitted by that AM radio tower to touch Earth. So you lay down 32, 64, whatever ground plane radials from the base of that radio tower. So as I see it, good radio grounding is to stop the RF energy from striking the Earth. You don't have to do anything near that enthusiastic when it comes to lightning or safety in most situations. But I got a gut feel this is not the whole answer. Back to you, Mel.
Actually, that's what they want to know. If you were putting it in, you were installing an amateur radio station, and you hooked up the equipment together, you got to a ground bus, so all the cabinets are tied together, and then you want to go to some kind of a ground. Simple. Do you put down one rod? Is that sufficient? Do you put down two rods? Should they be longer than 9 foot? In other words, what would you say would be adequate for the average amateur radio station? How many rods? You know, what kind of spacing? Or what would you do in your case, Dick Dover?
In my case, the grounding came kind of automatically, Mel. I'm a strong believer in earth screw anchors for my guy wires. So I've got a total of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 3. I have 9 earth screw anchors on one tower and 6 screw anchors on the other. These are 8 foot long rods, 1 inch diameter, with an 8 inch diameter Archimedes plate at the bottom, buried 8 feet into the ground, and a guy wire connected to it. And each of those guy wires have no insulators, no wake insulators along the guy wire, and the guy wire attaches to the tower at various altitudes. That creates a lot of grounding. It's a whole Christmas tree of grounding around that tower. I happen to have 2 more rods at the base of the tower, on the north side and on the south side, 8 foot long, 5/8 diameter, copper clad, connected with a piece of, I think it's 6-gauge wire, sunk below grade, just as an additional lightning grounding at the base. And I have 1 more ground rod where all the cables enter the house, and the cables are strapped to that ground rod at that point. I did almost all of that only for lightning. None of it I did it for radio. I did it all for lightning first and a little bit of human safety second. My equipment itself in the shack, I haven't gone hog wild with all kinds of grounding straps between. Just the coax cables that go to each piece of equipment, that plus the power cord has a third prong going to neutral, that's the only grounding of my equipment. I bet you've gone quite a bit further than that. Tell me what grounding you've got, Mel, and tell me the reason why you put in each one of those grounds. Back to you, K2LAW.
Thank you, Wyle.
Well, Bernie, we'll pick you up in a second. Mel first.
Hey, well, considering, of course, lightning was my first, consideration, especially with the tower poking up there, highest thing in the area here. You know, it's more than at least 50 feet over anything here at a minimum. So, and of course, here by the ocean here, you see some real beautiful displays here like we had tonight. I have down, first of all, I have a well in the backyard. That's, for watering the garden here, because some years ago they stopped us from using city water for watering because of water shortage, etc. They put a water meter in here and our business, so okay, we put down a well. And what I did is I put the well down, I drove the well pipe down, that goes down 36 feet into the water table. I welded each joint as it was going down. I just put a weld across each joint so the pipe is you know, good contact between the couplings and all. And then I put down rods around here. I have six 8-foot rods driven into the ground here, and it's all bonded together with number 6 wire that's all